business, gracious classmates, it is time for another episode of Art Class. Woohoo! Of course, this is Lincoln Center's podcast, all about decolonizing the arts industry and arts education. As always, I am your host, Rocky Jones, and I'm here with my two stupendous co-hosts, the lovely, wonderful, moisturized. You are stupendous.
I just didn't know. Where the first syllable of that was going for 1 second. It's like, is he really a doctor? And then you didn't. So.
Y'all, these next two folks are stupid. No, they're stupendous. They're stupefying there. And of course, I'm talking about the amazing Dr. Lou Bynum. Hello, Dr. Lou Bynum.
Good morning.
What country are we saying hi to this week?
We are saying hello to the beautiful island of Samoa.
Ooh, hi Samoa.
Ooh, hi Samoa.
Hi Samoa.
How and y'all doing?
Beautiful Samoan people and delicious Samoan food.
I've never all had of Samoan above. Food.
Oh, it's amazing. Where have you been?
Not Samoa.
Clearly.
And of course, that other voice you hear is the lovely, the talented, the always dressed to impress and moisturized Paige Reynolds. Hello, Paige.
Hello, hello.
How are you doing?
Wonderful. Thanks for saying I'm dressed to impress. I feel regular today.
I'm serving Sporty Spice in my my trucker hat and tourist t-shirt. So you look great.
Oh, thank you. Because I just threw on an earring that can really transform it, you know,
it's
make
true.
It look like you did something.
Mm-hmm. No, and your glasses are very stylish. Yeah. But enough pleasantries. We don't have time for this. We have very important news. My God, everyone, sound the alarm. Ring the alarm. If you are in New York tomorrow night, that is Wednesday, April 10th, you should come see us because we're going to do a live show.
What?
Yay! I know. Incredible. I cannot wait. I'm so excited to be back in the Big Apple, taking a big old bite. Y'all, I just say stuff. I don't know.
Well, this is why they can't take us anywhere, or we can't have nice stuff. So.
Well,
yeah.
We're going
can't
to
take
have...
us anywhere. Yet Lincoln Center is. And don't know how or why, but thanks.
Thank you, Lincoln Center. But yes, come see us tomorrow night at the David Rubenstein Atrium at Lincoln Center. The show starts at 7:30. It's going to be an incredible hour with the legendarious. There aren't enough takes on the word legendary to describe the incredible Nona Hendrix. And woo-hoo. I cannot wait. We were able to chat with her last week on a Zoom, just a little sort of interview before the interview. And she's just so fascinating and smart and cool and so into just the latest technology and putting people on and helping younger generations, you know, become successful, incredible artists just like her. And I cannot wait for this conversation.
Yeah, to talk to an icon who is iconing right now, right before our very eyes, And again, I will get on the soapbox and say, this is why we need to stop calling non-icons and non-legends legends and icons simply because they managed to walk across the street. When we actually have a real one in front of us, it feels like we don't have words enough to describe who they are, what they've done, and what it is that they are going to share with us. So perhaps we'll coin a new term for tomorrow's conversation with the true legend.
Indeed. Indeed. The thing about legends and icons is that, like, they never stop, like, legending and mm-hmm. iconing. Like, it's mm-hmm. not just the stroll across the street moment. So right. that Nona Hendricks could have this incredible career and just still be iconing, you know, like it's nothing, just, you know, just, she just, you know, wakes up every morning and casually decides to be iconic. And, and sure now even, bringing us Afrofuturism and funk and just, it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun.
Incredible. So tomorrow night, 7:30, David Rubenstein Atrium. It's going to be a show you do not want to miss. Check out the link in the show notes. Tickets are free.
General admission, first come, first serve, just show up. Or fast track, opening Monday before the event at noon.
Oh, well, there you go.
All there right. we go.
So yeah. check that out at lincolncenter.org. The link will be in the show notes. And come see us. It's going to be fun. We're going to have so much fun. But we have a fantastic show for you today, right now, to wet your whistle before tomorrow night. We have first up the, or well, later on in the show, I should say, we have the second part of the interview with Hannah Mae Rhee of the Black Banjo Reclamation Project, part of Paige's Kinfolk series. Can't wait for part two. Yay. Part one was so... Yeah. fun and cool and interesting, like really, really fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And timely.
And timely.
Hello? Hi.
Sure, we will have some things to say about Cowboy Carter at some point once somebody finally listens to it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, mm-hmm. I know who that was directed at. And my feelings are not hurt.
Wait, both of you haven't listened to it?
They, okay. See, I'm not the only one. Here's yeah. my thing. I need to be in the right space. I mm-hmm. want to be fully present. Mm-hmm. I don't want to have to pause. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be interrupted. And so it's really an act of respect mm-hmm. and reverence okay. that I have not listened to it yet.
Yes. And okay. I saw all 137 tracks listed. And that's when I knew that I needed to allocate a block of time to sit down and listen and process. Because I also know that she's doing covers of some of my favorite songs. She's working mm-hmm. with some artists that I have loved for a while. Linda Martell, Dolly Parton, and also some people who I don't know. So yeah, this is a Beyonce album. This isn't just like listening to any old body where I can just put it mm-hmm. on and be washing the dishes or whatever. I don't wash the dishes, but like put it on and Damon's washing the dishes or whatever. Like I actually need to sit down and think about this. So
yeah.
I see. Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. Friday was a lovely day. And so I just put on my AirPods and I took a walk around the lake and I made time. For Beyonce. Oh. Oh, excuse me. And I will say that it is a masterpiece and you will not be disappointed once you do finally get around to making time for the queen. No, but seriously, it is. I know that I'm a Beyonce stan, and so perhaps people will not take this as seriously as perhaps they should or as I mean it, but I think it is like one of my top three albums of all time. It's up there.
Wow.
It's wow. really, really incredible. And the number of influences that it There's so much I want to say about it. So maybe we should save it for a time when we have, you know, a little bit more space.
But it does actually really appeal to me what you're saying, though, because for me, like, the whole point of thinking about Black music is thinking about how expansive it is, mm-hmm. thinking about how much our roots touch every conceivable genre that we have in America. And I like people perhaps using this album as some sort of jumping off point to thinking more broadly about our foundations. And that also sets us up beautifully for this afternoon's kinfolk, as well as thinking about who James Baldwin was. We have a really amazing, amazing conversation with the amazing Pulitzer Prize winning writer Hilton Ahls about amazing, amazing other writer, James Baldwin, two of my all-time favorites in one conversation with the two of you. It's absolutely wonderful. Of course, Hilton worked on the God Made My Face exhibit, really featuring the work of James Baldwin and thinking very broadly about his contributions, not just to literature, but also to film and visual arts. And there's a new book about the exhibit, which came out on March 19th. So make sure you check that out. But we were really thinking a lot about the relationship between James Baldwin and Black sound today. Mm. And I'm really, really happy to be able to share some of that with the folks.
Absolutely. And, you know, James Baldwin is just one of my sort of heroes, literary heroes. And I remember I must have been, gosh, in my early 20s. So so long ago. And I was working at Olson's Books and Records in Washington, D.C. R.I.P. Olson's Books and Records. I got my hands on a copy of Another Country. And that book really it's just the way he was able to construct a sentence so beautifully, so that it was just so artistically just staggering, but also just emotionally staggering, but also like was just so clear and concise. It was incredible. And I was just like, oh my God, I want to write like that. I want to sound like that. Like, how did you get such a gift? Where do I go buy this?
I mean, what's sitting with me right now is its connection to Beyonce. We were just talking about. I like how Baldwin points out that, you know, context really, really matters when it comes to music, and throughout my life, I've heard all kinds of situations where people try to take music away from its context and, you know, go, it's just art and everyone should be able to enjoy the art and make the art however they want. But when we're talking about American music, especially, like, it is all inevitably going to be connected to slavery, the history of Black people being enslaved, being oppressed, the way Baldwin, you know, argues that, you know, slavery never went away, that it just, you know, the look of it just changed, which in many ways I really agree with. And so I think that's part of why Beyonce's Cowboy Carter is so refreshing to people and like deeply resonant, because it's like, here's someone performing country music and other kinds of genres that are usually not associated with Black people in the mainstream, and putting some of that context back to it. It sounds different coming out of a Black woman's mouth. Mm-hmm. It just does. And Baldwin talks about that. So feels very relevant to the moment that Beyonce is creating in music right now.
Absolutely. And he also wrote a lot about how Black music functions on two levels, right? The sort of level of text and then the level of subtext, and thinking a lot about the ways that Black artists often interpret things, kind of anything, on both levels. And one of the reasons that Black art is so appealing, but also maybe so hard to get right when wrested from its context, has to do with those multiple interpretive layers. And I think the places where we're probably the most familiar with this are around Negro spirituals, right? Where so many of them had whatever words that they had that were connected to Christianity in whatever ways that they were connected, but oftentimes also were meant to carry messages between African Americans who were enslaved at that time, or other messages of hope, or sometimes literal directions that were meant to be shared. And I think that that is something that we still continue to see in hip hop, we see in dance hall, we see in R&B. And I think Baldwin's way of problematizing how Black music is sometimes co-opted and exploited has to do with how much meaning is lost when you do divorce it from that context. I find all that really, really compelling. And I don't think it's just true of Black music, right? Like, I think if you pick up Toni Morrison, or if you pick up August Wilson or Lynn Nottage, or Octavia Butler, I think you will also experience that level of communication and then a deeper set of meanings that sometimes I think are meant specifically for the Black audience as well. And these are things that I talked about a lot when I used to teach Baldwin. I did not actually teach him. He died in 1987. When I taught his, just to be clear, when I taught his work to undergrads, it would be, but I was taught by one of his proteges, Amiri Baraka, when I was in college. So I am, in fact, actually old, but just not that old. And on another art class, we should absolutely talk about Amiri Baraka's work and how multifaceted that was. But that's another story for another day. But really, really excited to bring this in and to announce that this summer we're going to be doing some work around James Baldwin's centennial. So please stay tuned for that. We hope all of you will join us for that, not just on this podcast, but in person. So stay tuned for an announcement soon.
Yes, stay tuned for that. And stay tuned for this wonderful conversation that we just had with Hilton Alls. And we will be right back after this.
And we're back, everybody, and we are super excited about our guest today. It is one of my favorite writers for as long as I can remember. We are so lucky to have him with us today. Thank you so much for being with us today, Hilton Alls.
My pleasure.
Hilton Alls is an award-winning journalist, critic, and curator. He has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1994. Alls also was a staff writer for The Village Voice and an editor at large at Vibe. He has received numerous awards for his work, including the Pulitzer Prize for Criticism in 2017, Yale's Wyndham Campbell Literature Prize in 2016, and a Guggenheim Fellowship in 2000. His first book, The Women, was published in 1996. His next book, White Girls, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award and the winner of the Lambda Literary Award in 2014. His most recent book, My Pinup, was published in November 2022. In 2017, he curated the critically lauded exhibition, Alice Neal Uptown. In 2019, he presented God Made My Face, a collective portrait of James Baldwin. And in 2022, Toni Morrison's Black Book, and Joan Didion, What She Means. He is currently a teaching professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and has also taught at Columbia, Princeton, Yale, and Wesleyan universities. Thank you again for being with us.
Not at all, it's an honor.
So I expect that most listening to our show will have a great context for James Baldwin, but it would be really, really wonderful to hear your thoughts about his significance as well as what led to the exhibit and the subsequent book.
He had had a inevitable and sizable influence on me as a kid. I used to do some work for a friend of his, an older gentleman who was mentoring me at that time. And so the connection between Baldwin's written work and his life were always very tangible to me. He was a living author always because of the friendship that he had had with this other gentleman. And I read him, and I think that what he really did was release me from the idea that speaking from the I point of view was egocentric. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, now that you've asked me this very good question, I think he made me less ashamed of what a lot of Black people feel, which is shame about speaking, putting the I forward. And it never occurred to me until just this minute when we were speaking that he released me from thinking that it was a kind of cage of egocentrism that only white authors were allowed to speak in this way, to reveal family secrets, to have a narrative of the self. And I think I'm so grateful to be on this program because I wouldn't have thought of that without speaking to you. But I think that what that allowed me to do was to understand that putting myself forward was part of the story that I was meant to tell. So his significance now, I think, is to release us collectively from the burden of verbal subjugation, that we're not worthy of talking about the I. And I think that he released us from that. I don't like to speak about him generally at all. I think that we do that too much with him, his life and his work. I think we should honor the work by reading it. But I would say that the example of Baldwin gave me that freedom to say I, that it was not a terrible selfish act. You know, that your I was part of your story and worthy of telling.
I have a follow-up to that. I agree that we talk about him very generally often. Yeah. And I think our culture is often obsessed with making a celebrity and leaders and heroes, and often from taking the snappiest sound bites and kind of flattening the rest. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you can speak to ways that we're representing Baldwin in this moment, especially in the mainstream, that might actually be untrue to his values or how he lived his life, or that is just flattening him as a person.
Right. I think that a big thing to consider is his own relationship to his body and to his, I think, worthiness of love, being in love with someone or being loved by someone. I think he, if you read the sort of last interview with Richard Goldstein, AIDS was just beginning, and he was asking questions that were very naive about the disease, and which showed me that he was not in touch with the ways in which sex was decimating other gay people. Mm-hmm. That he was in far away in France, and he was by then becoming ill. So I think it was, when I read that interview, it was an indication to me that he hadn't been connected to someone in a long time, if ever, really, because his relationship to Lucien Hapesberger, his first boyfriend in Paris, was fraught. Lucien preferred women. A lot of the guys preferred women. And I think that if you go to Giovanni's room one of the things that is so astonishing in it really is the way in which he talks about masculinity and the question of masculinity and whether or not a gay person can be masculine or a bi person can be feminine. I think he was very much of his time in that way, that that the homosexual, he equated the homosexual with weakness, which would mean that he equated himself with a kind of femininity or weakness that was kind of verging on misogyny. So I think he wasn't really good in that department. I don't think he was good in his relationship to how to write about women at all, except for the first novel, Go Tell It on the Mountain, which has full portraits of the women who raised him. I think that what we can learn as certainly as gay people is how much more freedom we have now to express what we're interested in, and it's not in a heteronormative frame. I don't know if that answers your question, but your question prompted that response.
It definitely answered it. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, one thing that I've been thinking about a lot, you know, I first discovered James Baldwin sort of in my late teens, early 20s. And I'd always grown up fancying myself a writer. I was, you know, an English major and all of these things. And once I finally escaped academia with my life, barely.
Good for you. Very healthy choice.
Yes. I thought
I was encouraged by a very great professor of mine not to become an academic.
Yes.
Because you can't, they don't like that kind of freedom. I love teaching, but I'm not an academic.
Yes. Yeah. And I felt so just kind of stifled, and I just sort of had to run away. So I ran back to DC where I'm from, and I started working in a bookstore, and the manager in the bookstore gave me a copy of Another Country and said, I think you'd really like this. And so in reading it, I was just sort of struck by just the musicality of his prose, just as a queer Black man, sort of kind of beginning my journey. I'm still sort of struggling with my queer identity. I'm just sort of realizing that there was somebody who had been thinking about all of these things, and, you know, 50, 60 years earlier, it was astonishing to me. I'd never really sat down and had somebody who was teaching me in this way. And so, you know, I found it extremely inspiring. But I was reading in God Made My Face, you say at one point that Baldwin's life and career, very inspiring, but it was also a bit of a cautionary tale. And then I was thinking about that, and I was like, that's a really interesting notion. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Sure. I think this goes back to the beginning of our conversation when I was talking about how I'm resistant to talking about him generally. And in speaking about him generally, people claim him as a kind of voice of Blackness. Less queerness, actually, than Blackness. And I think that one of the things that happens is that the nuance of his writing and the various complications gets, as you say, it gets rolled out or flattened out so that people sort of pluck from what he's said without necessarily reflecting or absorbing it. So I think that what happened when he came back to work as a civil rights activist in 64, he came back before, but then in 64 he was really sort of here in America for a while. I think that what happened was that the writing became not the writing in service to the artist, but writing in service to a cause. And so in that way in which writing becomes a service to a cause, you flatten out the nuance because you're speaking to a general audience. You have to forget nuance and you have to embrace a kind of rhetoric that is accessible to a lot of people. So I think that his self, his artistry suffered because you have to not write for the many, but for the one. And I think that his writing for the many had a kind of terrible effect on his relationship to his writing and to the self and also queerness, right? Because there were no civil rights activists who were out. That would harm the movement. So there were lots of ways in which closet doors were closing. He may have had, of course he had a great cause to work with, but I think it was at the expense of his artistry, actually.
And as a follow-up, may I ask a question about maybe how the exhibit gave you an opportunity to perhaps present a corrective? Because there is something that you said in the New Yorker, and I'll read it. It goes back to an idea.
You know, what's that wonderful Joan Didion quote where she says, the danger of being a writer is the public humiliation of seeing your words in print. lay it on me.
It's much the same for podcasters, I can assure you.
Okay. So you stated, it goes back to an idea which is very important to me about giving Baldwin back his body, his spirit, and his corporeal self. Now we have him singing, and we have him filling space too. And I have to say, like, I was gobsmacked by the exhibit, still thinking about it many, many seasons later. When I was teaching FM at Columbia, I would frequently have this takeaway that he had just been like completely decontextualized, or in some instances maybe appropriated by various groups. So seeing the exhibit, I felt like I was learning about Baldwin for the first time, and I felt like I had this, you know, kind of sophisticated relationship to him. So I'm curious to hear a little bit about what it meant for you to be able to place him back in his body.
Oh, it was a great experience, and I have to thank David Zwirner really for giving me the space to do it after having this experience. I realized that we can bring them back, and we can bring them back through fragments. The things that they, as a friend of mine, the things that they leave behind. So Baldwin's body was manifest in several ways. One was a recording of him singing Amazing Grace. Another was manuscripts that were unpublished, and also his relationship to the visual world. That there were, you know, Kara Walker's film could have been made from a scenario that he wrote. So what it meant for me personally was that he was a vibrant person, and that he wasn't one. We're all myriad beings, and that this portrait was a myriad example and feeling about Baldwin that allowed us to see that he had arms and a head and a voice and body and cigarette breath and all of these things, all of the stuff that was amazingly in your face. You know, I wanted you to experience him in the sense that you could take him away with you, as opposed to flattening him out. We were going to give you a three-dimensional show that really was about being absorbed in his aura and body and yours at the same time.
That's beautiful. That's so beautiful.
Thank you.
No, I feel like
you guys are inspiring me, and I'm going off on these tangents where I'm like, wait, what? Did I answer the question?
Oh, they're not tangents to us at all.
Okay, good. Okay, good.
Not at all. And I mean, your question, Lee, and your answer, Hilton, are getting me thinking about how people like Baldwin now, especially Black, queer, and gay folks who are artists, who are writers, in this day and time, just given like the mainstream perception changing, are maybe able to hold like their Blackness and their queerness in a ways that maybe Baldwin didn't always have access to, right. Or that maybe cut off from him.
I think, to be honest, he was as much a part of his upbringing, his times, as anybody else. Mm-hmm. And he grew up in that church, the Black church. Mm-hmm. Now, I have a lot of issues with that. I didn't grow up in the Black church, so I can say it. But I, you know what I was really happy to hear and see was in the Nikki Giovanni documentary. Have you guys seen it?
I cannot wait to see it. Oh, it's so excited. It's oh, so my gosh. Good.
But she has this moment that is so profound, and she's in the Black church with her partner, who's a white woman, and she starts talking about her partner, and she just looks at her and she says, and if you have a problem with that, that's your problem. And I thought, I started to cry, but I think that he wasn't able to lead on some level. I think when I was in St. Paul de Vence, this woman who had been involved with his brother was telling me that the family had come and put like crosses on the lawn, practically to exercise the queerness in the house, you know, where he lived with men. And I just think that he didn't even get far enough to France, you know, to kind of distance himself from that world. I don't think it was helpful to him in the end. I don't know how much he expelled it in the end, but I love him for having tried, you know?
Absolutely. I did grow up in the Black church, and I can, I will also openly say, you know, it could be some of your greatest source of community and your greatest antagonizer at the Amen. Same time.
Yeah. Bless you. I had such an interesting, weird mother that I just didn't have any relationship to that stuff, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, shoot, you may have got out lucky.
Getting out of acting and academic. So it was the same thing. I was inspired not to be an academic, so.
Well, I know we are getting down to the end of the time that we have with you today, but I really wanted to ask one additional question, which was kind of, it's kind of been burning for me for a while, and I feel like I wanted to talk to you for at least 25 years, and now that I have you,
Captain, I have to ask this question. you could have called me up at any time.
Well, now that I know. So, yes, but putting Baldwin in our rear view a little bit, I'm curious because on this show and our previous show, we've talked a lot about how we feel like there is this commodification of queer Black culture that's been happening for the last couple of years. And it may or may not suggest things about how we are being mainstreamed, appropriated, or any number of other things. And I'm just kind of curious from where you sit, does it feel like we are in any kind of moment vis-a-vis queer Black culture, or is this just a part of a cycle of appropriation that pops up every couple of years?
I think that there's a lot of exciting stuff that is happening out there because there's less conflict about speaking, right? So that if we have Baldwin as an example and as a source of inspiration to speak, I think that there's a lot of interesting stuff that could happen if we free ourselves from ideology. And if we free ourselves from ideology, then we're able to speak narratively, personally, and that's what I'm looking forward to. There are wonderful people who are coming up. I read this book by Carvel Wallace that I liked a lot, and I think that there's a lot that I'm excited to look forward to. We have to free ourselves at the moment from an over-reliance on correctness, and over-reliance on ideological safety And I think to put nuance and wildness back in conversation and in the art, we'll honor Baldwin much more greatly that way than sort of towing a line. And it'll free him too, I think. It'll free him further from the tyrannies, various tyrannies that he had to live through in order to speak at all. So let's help him out by being free ourselves.
Ashe.
Yeah, Ashe, absolutely. So are there any artists out there, any writers that you feel are really doing
Oh.
that you know you're really excited about that you wanna to share and chat
I,
out?
that Carvell Wallace book is pretty really good. It's funny, you know, I read so many old books because I don't know anything, but I'm gonna start catching up. Oh, I rediscovered Essex Hemphill and Marlon Riggs. That have people, folks really need to go back to reading them. And I think in my classes, I have kids that I know that are coming up to be really interesting writers.
Well, that's exciting.
Is
The
exciting.
future.
Yes, it is exciting. I feel very fortunate to, teaching is not really a job, it's a vocation, and I really enjoy helping them get to that place.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for
Thank
giving of
you.
your time today. Everybody, go to HiltonNiles.com, check that out, follow him on Instagram, all of those fun things. All those links will be in the show notes. And once again, thank you so much for being here
Thank you
and for
so much for having
sharing
me.
your
Thank
wisdom.
you.
And thank you, and be good and safe, okay?
You
You
too, you
too.
too.
You
And we will
too.
be right back with the rest of the show, everybody.
Hello, classmates. It's Emile here again to bring you the morning announcements. I'm your resident violinist with a passion for arts collaboration, and I'm here to encourage you to go experience live art. The following is a short list of events and experiences that we here at Art Class think are cool and maybe you should check out. If you were inspired by the James Baldwin conversation and interested to know more, Hilton Ahl's new book, God Made My Face, A Collective Portrait of James Baldwin, hit bookstores just a few weeks ago. Nearly 40 years after James Baldwin's passing, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Hilton Ahl has compiled and edited a book devoted to James Baldwin, illuminating the person behind the powerful words. The publication follows and builds upon the exhibition that Ahl staged at the David Zwirner Museum in 2019. In the exhibition, Hilton Ahl employed art and archival material to illuminate James Baldwin's life, his sexuality, aestheticism, and his humanitarian work. God Made My Face, A Collective Portrait of James Baldwin, launched March 19th, 2024, and you can get your copy wherever you buy books. In another celebration of this great human, the Literary Freedom Project presents a year-long celebration of James Baldwin. The project is titled James Baldwin at 100, and will encompass discussions, panels, screenings, and exhibitions, focusing on a wide array of literary works and ideas. The year-long celebration will spotlight the power of literature in fostering dialogues and crucial topics such as social justice, racism, gentrification, women's empowerment, and policing. Each book they present by James Baldwin will be paired with a writer whose work focuses on a similar subject matter, and the discussions will go on throughout the year. The celebration culminates at the Mosaic Literary Conference of Love at the Bronx Museum on November the 16th. Learn more about this project at onebookonebronx.com. Finally, I'm giving you a glimpse into my own life as a performing artist and two new organizations started by colleagues and musician friends of mine that I am super excited about. The Sugar Hill Salon is one of the first chamber music series and artistic collectives that centers on Black and Brown woodwind artistry in classical music. They are a Black and queer-owned organization that offers free public concerts in Harlem that showcase repertoire that lacks representation within traditional chamber programming, all performed by Black and Brown musicians lifting up this art form. Through monthly concerts featuring artists on the scene and commissioning new chamber works, The Sugar Hill Salon is decolonizing classical music for a more equitable future for Black and Brown communities. So I gave you one in the States, and now we take this ish international. The Ensemble Obiora. Based in Montreal, Canada, the mission of the Ensemble Obiora is to promote musicians from different cultural backgrounds in order to increase their representation in the classical music scene, and to program unfamiliar works by composers of color whose contributions have gone unnoticed. Founded on the principles of diversity, discovery, and dissemination, the Ensemble Obiora strives to bring a new and diverse voice to classical music in Canada, to create the sense of belonging for underrepresented communities and to inspire the next generation of classical musicians. Both of the ensembles I just mentioned have performances coming up in April and May. If you'd like more information on any of the things I've highlighted in the announcements, check out the links in the show notes, and I'll be back next time with more cool live art for you to experience. Bye, friends.
Welcome back to Kinfolk, a segment where we explore the artistic and cultural traditions of Black folks all across the diaspora, from the Caribbean to Turtle Island to the UK and back to our common root on the African continent. This is part two of our conversation with the Black Banjo Reclamation Project, retracing the Black roots of the banjo, the people who have stewarded this instrument and its traditions for years and years. And we're going to talk some more about what it means for Black folks to reconnect with the land, with each other, and maybe even with some reparations through the instrument of the banjo. So stay tuned. I hope you enjoy this part two of our conversation with the Black Banjo Reclamation Project. Enjoy. We're both birth workers also. Shout out to that. You know, I had to get into like how being an artist and a radical artist at that. I love that you said radical arts administrator too. And how does that like intersect with birth work and even reproductive justice for Black folks?
Definitely. This is kind of where like it's been more in my personal work that I've been able to like work in, you know, the field of birth work and birthing people. But it's like all of the things that I've learned through birth work are also things that I'm bringing to my work as an administrator and working with BBRP. I think like it's just interesting going through and being able to find teachers and doing doula trainings. I had actually only attended one birth before I had my baby 8 months ago. And so like, I feel like I learned so much from preparing, you know, to support other people. And then having the experience myself, I feel like definitely hands down has made me a better birth worker and made me a better community member, because I see how much support is needed when you are going through a huge transformation. And I think that anything that you pick up, anything that you're doing for your healing, and that includes the banjo, like it requires support, and it requires having somebody, having people in general in your corner who know what you're going through. Because, and I think we've sort of spoken of this, like when you are playing the banjo or when you're having a baby, there are so many other things that come up. You might not even know what is. You have to be stepping into the unknown, and you have to be prepared that your body and like your spirit is literally going to just be giving you information, and like you're receiving that. And so just to have that understanding that what we're doing is transforming and changing, and being witnessed in doing that. So, I mean, birth work is something similar to working with the banjo that like people don't understand how much of that knowledge literally comes from Black and African people. That's where the information of our entire society knowing, you know, what they know about birthing people comes from. And then at the same time, similar to how you might go, I might go to a drum circle I might hear, you know, African drumming in the distance, and I'd be like, oh, wow, I'm feeling called to the drum, you know? And you go, and it's like, you see one Black person, you know? Mm. That's what it's like in birth work, too, sometimes. Yeah. That's what it feels like, because it's just something that is yours, but now you're being treated as if you're an outsider, and essentially they don't, a lot of these birth workers, they absolutely do not include Black people and Black birth and Indigenous birth in their trainings or in any of the things that they're doing, and it's completely erased. So it really is, once again, coming home to what is innate and what is natural and what is healthy for us as people, which is to know about these things. How would the world be different if everybody studied birth and everybody knew what that was like? You know, people knew about breastfeeding, people knew about babies, you know, and life and what it takes to foster that, like, in community. So basically, I think that music and birth go hand in hand, and it's a way to combat some of our fears, to be witnessed. You know, you have to be vulnerable when you give birth.
Mm-hmm.
You're in such a vulnerable position, you know, that the more things that we can do that are empowering to us, that is how we're going to feel secure to be able to go through that transformation and bring new life into the world. And that really goes, you know, for the healing that we get with music, is like, you have to dive in, and it's scary. It's scary to learn something new. It's scary to share something that you haven't shared with other people and be vulnerable. And so I really, you know, see these things as hand in hand, that we can use music as a tool to keep reclaiming the parts of ourselves that maybe we're not as connected with, we haven't had the opportunity to be connected with, and the thing that the more we show in the world, the more people are going to be able to know that they can do those things too.
Yeah. Yeah. I think of both of them as just Black folks being able to reclaim a more, like, intuitive, more like sensual and empowering relationship with our bodies. So much of, like, what it looks like for us to reclaim birth is to reclaim the spiritual part of it, like and yeah, we did talk a little bit about the banjo and the things that came up the first time I picked up one that a white person gifted to me, thank you, and put it back in Black hands. And I was gonna look up a YouTube video or look up lessons, and I was like, no, let me just, like, sit here and just start plucking. And I don't know, I lost track of time. I felt like I floated somewhere else for a minute. But dealing with birth is often like that too, if you're actually tuning in, and like, what medicine that is for Black people to have more moments like that where we can just be really, like, present within ourselves. Yeah.
That is, yeah, so true. And like, it was also just really cool to, like, have a baby and, like, play the banjo and, like, really, like, respond, like, they were responding to it, like, in the womb, like, it would there's so many, like, beautiful things that I know are coming just through, like, you know, us having these conversations and recognizing that power. And, like, that's what I want to share through my work, and, you know, want to advocate with through Black Banjo Reclamation Project for sure.
Yeah. What are some of the things that you've heard or transformations you've witnessed just around with people who have been part of Black Banjo Reclamation Project, who have made their own banjo, or who have been connecting with others who also love the instrument? Yeah. What are you seeing and hearing?
Yeah. As far as playing the music, I think it's similar to what you were saying, where it's like, when we're willing to kind of take that risk and devote that time to our practice and to ourselves, it, like, has benefits, and it has a visceral way that people are responding to that. Like, having your hands on something when maybe you've never played an instrument, you know what I mean? And having the banjo for many people be the first instrument that they've ever had or had access to or had support in, I think that that's huge. Being able to just explore something on your own is really can be really freeing, because it's like we're creating a space for people to not be shut down when they first start something, because it can be scary and it can be vulnerable, and like it's not something that we have to compare ourselves to other people in, because it is a practice that's like ultimately for ourselves that we can choose to share with people. But with building, it's been a similar situation. Like I was not somebody that was like given a lot of access to building things growing up. I think when you're socialized, you know, assigned female at birth person in general, and I think a lot of people who of all genders are have experienced too, just like not having access to learning to work with your hands as a craft and as a form of engineering, as a form of creativity, and like creating something in the world that didn't exist before. That was a new experience for me that I was able to have through Black Banjo Reclamation Project. And I think a lot of other people kind of share that, where it's like you definitely connect with, it's a way to connect with ancestors and, you know, familial as well as just ancestors of the craft, you know, to put yourself in that position of like knowing those steps, knowing the parts of the banjo, knowing about the neck, knowing about the body, knowing about the goat skin, like that's all ancestral knowledge. And so going through that process, whether that's over the course of 3 days, like we some of our workshops last about 3 days, some of our workshops will do that in about a week span of time, like full time every day for 7 days or more. And then we also have transitioned that program to be like a youth program that we have done in Chicago a few times, where we do that over the course of like 5 or 6 weeks. That's visceral knowledge that we're gaining. So not only are you like learning the practical things about the banjo, like how it's set up, how to put it together with the strings, the bridge, the tailpiece, you know, the nut, all of these parts come together, and it's actually like pretty simple once you know. That's a type of ancestral knowledge that just is like, oh wow, so many people have done this, so many people have tapped into this technology of what it meant to create sound in this way. I think a lot of people, you know, have also just appreciated the fact that once they made their banjo, they had a banjo to take home with them. Like they were then actually having a banjo that they made that was made out of a gourd, being able to experience what it's like to have a piece of wood that you cut out yourself and that you are like sanding down and like making into a neck that you're going to hold. You know, some banjos, like I have a banjo that was like gifted to me through Black Banjo Reclamation Project at one point several years ago when I was asking for a fretless banjo. This is like 100-year-old banjo. Like these banjos will literally us. Like this wood that we're creating, like the tree that actually provided that, that's literally something that will be here a long time potentially after we are gone. So I think it's really important for people to have that experience. Like some of those people will go on to like do banjo repair or to actually become luthiers, you know, like, and we've also worked with we had the pleasure of being able to work with one of the only female Black violin makers, luthiers, who was actually at our last workshop. Her name's Amanda Ewing. And she's just an amazing woman who lives in Nashville. And it's just, that has been a huge privilege to like bring this knowledge to people of all different like walks of life and people who are accessing it for different reasons, really, you know, because all of these people who are culture bearers are now able to incorporate the knowledge that they have with banjo into the practices that they already do. So maybe that's dance, maybe that's ceramics, maybe that's teaching, you know, facilitating or building, being a woodworker or a singer, like that is contributing something to the practice of what you already do. So that's like been really, really amazing to just get to support artists in that way.
Yeah. I wonder, we're going towards the end of this interview. Before we go, how can people keep supporting you and your art, keep supporting Black Banjo Reclamation Project? Let us know where to find you and yeah, how people can stay up to speed about what you have going on.
Definitely. Yeah. Thank you so much for that plug. Yeah, for myself, you know, my name is Hannah Mae Ree. You can find all of my music under that name, you know, Spotify, YouTube, different things like that, Instagram. And for Black Banjo Reclamation Project, like, our website should be, you know, the central site as well as Instagram. You should be able to find information from there. We're working on setting up a lot of different systems that will make it easier for people to, like, not only make inquiries, but just find what they're looking for in what it is that we do. I'm always down to, like, set up kind of like onboarding calls and, like, talk to people about, like, what it is that they're looking for. And then, like, people like myself and other of my colleagues, we also, like, teach banjo. So, you know, we can help people who are either getting started or maybe they're more advanced and they want to continue their work with banjo and they want to do that, like, with Black people. They want to do that in a way where they can continue learning on their own terms. You know, you can reach out to us for that. And we also, this should probably be on our website. Like, you'll eventually be able to find more information on, like, what we're doing with our banjo brokerage program. So, like, distributing banjos, putting banjos in people's hands through, like, a scholarship program that we're creating now. And yeah, there's just a lot more, you know, we typically have online offerings as well as in-person stuff. So look out, be on the lookout. We will have several, like, always we're looking to have as many entry points to get in touch with us as possible so that people can find what they're looking for and just have the support on that part of the journey that they're in.
Wonderful. I am just so excited that you could join us today. I've been following BVRP for a minute, actually for a few years. And so I am just delighted. And y'all heard all of that. You heard all the ways you can plug in, continue to support the work. Thank you so, so much for being here, Hannah. And class is on break. We will be right back.
All right, and we are back. Thank you for another illuminating kinfolk page.
You're very welcome. It was my pleasure.
Yes, yes, yes. So good, so good. And now it is time for our favorite part of the show. It is time for Pure Black Joy. Yes, PBJ, a little snack for your soul. This is the part of the show where we highlight all of the Black people, places, things, culture, art, music that is making us happy this week. And this week's PBJ is coming from Dr. Lee Bynum. Hello, Dr. Lee Bynum.
Hello. Again, Samoa.
Still Samoa.
Well, there's some super interesting news coming from our friends at the Perelman Performing Arts Center here in New York City. From June 20th through July 14th, they are presenting the legendary musical Cats by Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber, but presented through the lens of a drag ball. And the musical, right? I know. And initially you're like, huh. And then you hear who is involved with it, including the legendary, again, real legends here, people, legendary House of LaBeija. And yes. And also many others from the drag scene, as well as a cast of Broadway actors, including the great, another legend, Andre DeShields. They are bringing told through a very different lens, costumes, choreography, music, all interpret it to make sense as part of the drag ball scene. So I am super, super excited about that. A little low-key insulted. They didn't call me to play Grisabella, but maybe they already have that worked out.
Touch me, touch the skin, touch the fur. Yeah. Touch the fur, touch all of the fur.
I can't stand you. But that is where I will be for at least one of those nights. I'm really, really curious to see it. Really, really excited to see our culture showing up in this context and also being brought to you by us. I yes. think that is very important in moments like this. So super excited. Congratulations to everybody involved. And yes, take my money, take all my money.
I mean, that's kind of cool. I mean, like when you first said it, I was kind of side-eyeing a little bit. But then when you said who was involved, that sounds pretty dope. That sounds pretty
I mean,
that awesome.
Just made sense to me immediately because Katz is already so extra.
It really
so...
is.
Right.
It really is.
Why not?
Exactly.
Well, everybody check that out. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. That sounds super fun. And this whole show was super fun. Thanks again for another wonderful episode, y'all.
No, thank you.
And thank you to our guests. Thank you to Hilton Alls. And thank you to Hannah Mae Ree. Go check out the Black Banjo Reclamation Project. And all of the things will be down in the show notes as usual. And I think that's going to do it for this episode. We will catch you in 2 weeks, but any words of wisdom before then, y'all?
Support Black art.
Yes.
Yep.
Absolutely.
That part.
Including us tomorrow night, 7:30, at the David Rubenstein Atrium.
Well played.
Thank you very much. I do what I can. General admission, check us out at lincolncenter.org. Links below in the show notes. And we'll hopefully see you then. But if not, we'll definitely see you in 2 weeks. Bye, everybody.
Bye. Class dismissed.
Class is dismissed. I always forget to say that. Thank you so much for checking out Lincoln Center's Art Class. The show is hosted by Lee Bynum, Paige Reynolds, aka Mabole Inawale, and me, Rocky Jones. The show is produced and edited by yours truly. Our artwork is by Patricia Sanchez Navarro, and our music is Dope Skeletons by Frequently Asked Music. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can really help us out by telling all of your people about the show, subscribing on your podcast platform of choice, and yes, leaving us a positive review wherever you're listening, but especially on Apple Podcasts. It's a small act, but it really, really helps us out, and we just might read your review on air. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit the art class page at lincolncenter.org, follow all of Lincoln Center's various social media profiles, and feel free to reach out to us anytime at artclasspod@gmail.com. We'll see you next time, and until then, class is dismissed.